Well, some of you may know that for a certain amount of time, I had a terrible fear of flying. Actually, a terrible fear of falling and crashing, not so much flying. And I stayed out of airplanes for about 20 years, which caused some inconvenience in my life. But I pretty much got over it, as I recounted some weeks ago when my wife and I became engaged, and she said that she was going to Europe on her honeymoon, and I was invited to go along. That was going to entail getting on a plane. And over the years, I'm happy to say I have become desensitized to almost everything, but including flying. Some desensitizing is okay, and I'm really a pretty good flyer now. But still, stuff happens. And I was on a plane probably about 8 years ago coming down from Oakland. Beautiful, clear day. I'm talking to the guy in the seat next to me who's not somebody I'd normally talk to because he was way too neat and clean, and his hair was, he looked, you know, somewhere between military and engineer. You know, didn't look like a prospective UU. And so I was not letting my little light shine, what can I tell you? And we chatted for a while, and he told me, I asked him what he was doing, and he said he was coming down to L.A. to fly out of L.A. because he was a pilot and lived in Danville, and said, why in the world did you fly to go flying? And he said, because I love flying, and more importantly, I love gliding. And so we chatted for a while, and then I went off into a book and an iPod, and he went off into an engineering journal. And all of a sudden, coming in over the Tehachapis, I felt something that I had never felt before. And that was, it felt like hitting something. We just went, boom! And it wasn't a drop. It wasn't the turbulence that picks up for a couple of minutes and then goes away. It was like a boom, and it was gone. And I just looked at him. I like to think, not with terror in my eyes, and he just looked at me and said, wake turbulence. We just went through the wake of a plane that had come through. And I said, thank you very much, Sully. So it was, in fact, Sully Sullenberger. And he was my seatmate some 8 years ago. And obviously, when the story broke, I immediately thought about the fact that his great love was gliders. You know, sometimes karma really works out. But then I started, of course, to beat myself up. Why didn't I take advantage? He was somebody who was going to become famous. If I had to do this conversation again, the questions I'd ask, I wouldn't have been put off by just how neat and clean and precise he seemed to be. I would have paid more attention. I have a friend we had dinner with last night who said, you know, I used to go to Oxy, and I worked in the dining room. And this kid, Barry, I just never really gave much time or attention to. If only I had known, I would have given him larger helpings. I would have asked him questions. I would have been more involved and made some real contact with him. Now, if you get from this that somebody might be famous someday, so pay attention, that's the wrong lesson. The wrong lesson is I didn't pay more attention to those people who were famous even when they were famous. When I went to Ira Gershwin's house with my family, he was an old guy that had written old song lyrics. When I went to Arnold Schoenberg's house, it was like, who is this guy that writes music I don't even like? Only when I went to Oscar Levant's house did I pay attention, but that's because he had two daughters in school with me, and they were kind of cute. He did say one of the funniest things I'd ever heard. He came down one Saturday morning, and if you don't know who Oscar Levant was, he was one of the great neurotics of the 20th century. And he spent most of his time with his hand over his heart, not pledging allegiance, but waiting for the coronary. It was a true story. He went to spend a weekend as a guest at Harpo Marx's and stayed for 5 years until he married June, and then June made him move out and buy a house. Anyway, Oscar came down one morning and said, You know, I said something today that really disturbed me. Sometimes it's really easy to diagnose a narcissistic disorder. The lesson, however, is not about spending more time and paying more attention to famous people. There's a religious theme here. It's a religious theme in Judaism that anyone, the poor person in the street, could be the hidden Messiah. It's in Islam that the hidden imam can be anywhere, and so you ought to pay attention, to look inside. In Christianity, what you do for the least of these, you do for me. All of these religions say, pay attention. Look into the eyes of people. There's a play called Blown Sideways Through Life, and one of the last lines in the play is, everyone has a story that would stop your heart. And it's absolutely true. And we spend so little time looking deeply at each other. Eye aversion, fear. We look at the uniforms that people wear. We all profile. It's not just the TSA. Everybody profiles by language, by color, by race, by gender, by affectional style, by clothing. We have all of these markers, and they're not very good. They're not very good about telling us just how interesting and human and real and nourishing other human beings can be in our lives. Some of the most influential people on me, and everything I'm going to tell you is absolutely true, have two of the most influential people on me philosophically and religiously were shoeshine men. One black in Westwood and one Arab in Tunisia. Finley in Westwood was the person who introduced me to Immanuel Kant and Baruch Spinoza. He had read everything and everyone and was completely self-educated, and he worked ridiculous hours in order to put his four kids through university, where they all went successfully through the university, and two of them to graduate degrees. If you just heard his act and saw him from across the room, what wrong conclusions would you draw? If you just thought about the niche, you might never open the door and let in one of the great minds and hearts that ever touched my life. And he's somebody who touched and changed my life. Another, the shoeshine man in Tunisia, in the town of Nabil, was somebody, we were talking religion. And he talked about the five religions. And he said, why should we fight about our religions? And he was talking about Judaism, Islam, Christianity, Buddhism, and Hinduism. He said, why should we fight? They're all part of the same hand. Does one finger hate another finger? And I'm going, wow. You know, wow. And I said, yeah, they serve the same master, you. And he said, no. They serve God. Another double wow. Whether it's my theology or not, whether I became the greatest fan of the categorical imperative is not the issue. It is the depth, the complexity, the humanity, the interestingness of these people that you might have profiled out of your life, out of your arms, and out of your hearts, as I might have done. And it happens all the time. There are, and I alluded to this last week, there are ordinary, invisible heroes in our lives, in this room, in our congregations, and we don't think about it. We think about the famous ones, sure, Sully, and give Obama seconds on dessert, he could handle it. But there are all the regular heroes that we have. Right now, one of the heroes is Liz. And Liz Heaton has an open house and an open heart to Barbara Burns' family. That's doing the right thing every day is something that is generous and really heroic. I mentioned, I believe, Jim and Marge Kalman, who were in my Studio City church, who had adopted three special needs children before we even talked about special needs. They just did it because they thought it was the right thing, that there were these children languishing in homes, not being held, not being adopted, not being placed, not being loved. And they said, well, we have a home and we have hearts and we'll take them in. These were not people that won any kind of awards, not people that maybe you would seek out until you found out the ordinary, extraordinary heroism of their lives. Sam Weitzman, who lives in my mother-in-law's building, I never knew, but he was a hero of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. He never talks about it. He talks about everything else to drown out the demons, but he never talks about what he did during the war to stay alive and to keep other people alive. There are other heroes and heroines that we don't think about, don't talk about. I know that I've told this story, maybe not in this setting before. No, yes, I have in this setting before. And that is the ordinary heroism of this person. When our son David was getting married, Helene and I looked at the guest list that came from our mother-in-law, and there was somebody we didn't recognize. And, you know, you kind of understand if the parents put in people that weren't in the kid's life. But when you get down unto the second generation and somebody's showing up for the wedding and you go, Ma, you know how much we're paying per mouth for guests? What is this person doing on the list? And she said, she saved my life at Auschwitz. She gave me a piece of bread. The great, and this is not a contradiction, communist Catholic writer Ignazio Salone in Bread and Wine says that it is true, to the poor God does come in the form of bread. That was life. That was life that was shared. We never really know who's sitting next to us. We never really know what smile, what compliment, what remonstration, what correction, what encounter is going to make all of the difference in the world. The big things that we do, the small things that we do, and the fundamental humanity of everyone with whom we share this planet. I know that it's hard. There are people who are off-putting. And when I find somebody that instinctively I don't like, and find off-putting, they're almost always doing something that I do that I don't like in myself, and it's easier not to like them. But there are people that you don't like. That's okay. They still have stories and rights and something to contribute and something that we can contribute to them and to their lives. There are small acts, not great acts, but small acts that can make such a difference in the life of the world. Last week, the closing words were from Mother Teresa. And I thought they were going to be these words. So they weren't, and I'll do them because it fits in. Mother Teresa said that the secret in life is not in doing great things, but in doing small things with great love. It's so simple an idea and a pretty difficult practice to keep in the center of our hearts and minds and souls the true humanity of the other people whom we encounter and the power that we have in those encounters. Because what we know of ourselves, we don't know simply from sitting alone and chanting, although that can be part of a spiritual practice. What we know about ourselves is how other people react. We are contingent beings. I learn how I am and who I am by how people react to me. And that entails a contract. Because if I depend on you and people not in this room for my sense of self, for my very self, then that puts me in a contingent relationship with everyone whom I encounter. And I am part of how they see themselves, of how they feel about themselves, about whether they are worthy of a look, a glance, a smile, an embrace, and company. Truly the only, or at least the most valuable thing we have to give each other. Yeah, I'm fond of saying life is an incomplete information problem and you never really know who is sitting next to you. But, you know, there is no one thing to get. This is not S where you have to get it. There's no it here. It's really very simple. Human beings are worthy of our time and attention. It is an imperative to be connected to others and understand that connection. The world is in itself a miracle. And if you don't like the word miracle because it has magical connotations, okay. The world itself is an anomaly. Everybody happy now? It's an anomaly. Somewhere in space and time, we popped up here with the ability to laugh and to cry and to love and to wonder and to yell and to scream and to embrace each other and to turn away from each other. And there are all these choices, and the right thing sometimes is morally complex to know. But the basic right thing is really no mystery. It's existence that's the mystery. It's this life that's the mystery. And you know, this flash of light, whatever might have happened before, whatever may happen afterwards, this flash of light, which is each of our individual lives, which we share with each other, is a precious spark. A precious spark. And we fan that spark, in the image of E.E. Cummings, into a flame. We tend the fires, not simply of our own hearts, but of everyone else's. And there is, given the brevity, sub specie eternitatis, in view of the length of eternity, why make time for anger? Why make time for hatred? Why make time for bickering? There is life to be lived. There's love in every sense to be made. And there is this world and this precious existence and the remarkable power we have within it, as small and as brief as we are, that we should choose to embrace and to celebrate the mystery, the miracle, the anomaly, the potential, the reality of being here, being now, and being together.